more ruthless about what he destroyed. At the end, he considered his files on pay and promotion of subordinates, and decided to burn those too, since they might help enemy interrogation teams fix their priorities. The cardboard box was full. He hefted it on his shoulder and went outside. Jakes had the fire going in a rusty steel water tank propped up on bricks. A corporal was feeding papers to the flames. Van Damme dumped his box and watched the blaze for a while. It reminded him of Guy Fawkes' night in England, fireworks and baked potatoes, and the burning effigy of a 17th-century traitor. Charred scraps of paper floated up on a pillar of hot air. Van Damme turned away. He wanted to think, so he decided to walk. He left GHQ and headed downtown. His cheek was hurting. He thought he should welcome the pain, for it was supposed to be a sign of healing. He was growing a beard to cover the wound so that he would look a little less unsightly when the dressing came off. Every day he enjoyed not having to shave in the morning. He thought of Elena and remembered her with her back arched and perspiration glistening on her naked breasts. He had been shocked by what had happened after he had kissed her. Shocked, but thrilled. It had been a night of firsts for him. First time he had made love anywhere other than on a bed. First time he had seen a woman have a climax like a man's. First time sex had been a mutual indulgence rather than the imposition of his will on a more or less reluctant woman. It was, of course, a disaster that he and Elena had fallen so joyfully in love. His parents, his friends, and the army would be aghast at the idea of his marrying a wog. His mother would also feel bound to explain why the Jews were wrong to reject Jesus. Van Damme decided not to worry over all that. He and Elena might be dead within a few days. We'll bask in the sunshine while it lasts, he thought, and to hell with the future. His thoughts kept returning to the girl whose throat had been cut, apparently by Wolf, in Istanbul. He was terrified that something might go wrong on Thursday, and Elena might find herself alone with Wolf again.
This ends side two of cassette six of The Key to Rebecca. Please fast forward to the end before loading cassette seven. Cassette seven.
Looking around him, he realized that there was a festive feeling in the air. He passed a hairdresser's salon and noticed that it was packed out, with women standing waiting. The dress shop seemed to be doing a good business. A woman came out of a grocer's with a basket full of canned food, and Van Damme saw that there was a queue stretching out of the shop and along the pavement. A sign in the window of the next shop said, in hasty scribble, "Sorry, no makeup." Van Damme realized that the Egyptians were preparing to be liberated, and looking forward to it. He could not escape a sense of impending doom. Even the sky seemed dark. He looked up. The sky was dark. There seemed to be a gray swirling mist, dotted with particles, over the city. He realized that it was smoke mixed with charred paper. All across Cairo, the British were burning their files, and the sooty smoke had blotted out the sun. Van Damme was suddenly furious with himself and the rest of the Allied armies for preparing so equably for defeat. Where was the spirit of the Battle of Britain? What had happened to that famous mixture of obstinacy, ingenuity, and courage, which was supposed to characterize the nation? What, Van Damme asked himself, are you planning to do about it? He turned around and walked back toward Garden City, where GHQ was billeted in commandeered villas. He visualized the map of the El Alamein line, where the Allies would make their last stand. This was one line Rommel could not circumvent, for at its southern end was the vast, impassable Katara Depression. So Rommel would have to break the line. Where would he try to break through? If he came through the northern end, he would then have to choose between dashing straight for Alexandria and wheeling around and attacking the Allied forces from behind. If he came through the southern end, He must either dash for Cairo or, again, wheel around and destroy the remains of the Allied forces. Immediately behind the line was the Alam Halfa Ridge, which Van Damme knew was heavily fortified. Clearly, it would be better for the Allies if Rommel wheeled around after breaking through the line, for then he might well spend his strength attacking Alam Halfa. There was one more factor. The southern approach to Alam Halfa was through treacherous, soft sand. It was unlikely that Rommel knew about the quicksand, for he had never penetrated this far east before, and only the Allies had good maps of the desert. So, Van Damme thought, my duty is to prevent Alex Wolff telling Rommel that Alam Halfa is well defended and cannot be attacked from the south. It was a depressingly negative plan. Van Damme had come, without consciously intending it, to the Villa Les Oliviers, Wolff's house. He sat in the little park opposite it, under the olive trees, and stared at the building, as if it might tell him where Wolff was. He thought idly, if only Wolff would make a mistake and encourage Rommel to attack Alam Halfa from the south. Then it hit him. Suppose I do capture Wolff. Suppose I also get his radio. Suppose I even find the key to his code. Then I could impersonate Wolff, get on the radio to Rommel, and tell him to attack Alam Halfa from the south. The idea blossomed rapidly in his mind, and he began to feel elated. By now, Rommel was convinced, quite rightly, that Wolff's information was good. Suppose he got a message from Wolff saying the El Alamein line was weak at the southern end, that the southern approach to Alam Halfa was hard going, and that Alam Halfa itself was weakly defended. The temptation would be too much for Rommel to resist. He would break through the line at the southern end and then swing northward, expecting to take Alam Halfa without much trouble. Then he would hit the quicksand. While he was struggling through it, our artillery would decimate his forces. When he reached Alam Halfa, he would find it heavily defended. At that point, we would bring in more forces from the front line and squeeze the enemy like a nutcracker. If the ambush worked well, it might not only save Egypt, but annihilate the Africa Corps. He thought, I've got to put this idea up to the brass. It would not be easy. His standing was not very high just now. In fact, his professional reputation was in ruins on account of Alex Wolff. But surely they would see the merit of the idea. He got up from the bench and headed for his office. Suddenly, the future looked different. Perhaps the jackboot would not ring out on the tiled floors of the mosques. Perhaps the treasures of the Egyptian Museum would not be shipped to Berlin. Perhaps Billy would not have to join the Hitler Youth. Perhaps Elena would not be sent to Dachau. We could all be saved, he thought. If I catch Wolff. Part 3. Alam Halfa. Chapter 20. One of these days, Van Damme thought, I'm going to punch Bog on the nose. Today, Lieutenant Colonel Bog was at his worst. Indecisive, sarcastic, and touchy. He had a nervous cough which he used when he was afraid to speak, and he was coughing a lot now. He was also fidgeting, tidying piles of papers on his desk, crossing and uncrossing his legs, and polishing his wretched cricket ball. Van Damme sat still and quiet, waiting for him to tie himself up in knots.
Now look here, Van Damme. Strategy is for Auchinleck. Your job is personal security, and you're not doing very well.
Nor is Auchinleck, Van Damme said.
Bog pretended not to hear. He picked up Van Damme's memo. Van Damme had written out his deception plan and formally submitted it to Bog with a copy to the brigadier.
For one thing, this is full of holes, Bog said.
Van Damme said nothing.
Full of holes,
Bog coughed.
For one thing, it involves letting old Rommel through the line, doesn't it?
Van Damme said, perhaps the plan could be made contingent on his getting through.
Yes, now you see, this is the kind of thing I mean. If you put up a plan that's full of holes like that, given that your reputation is at a pretty damn low point around here at the moment, well, you'll be laughed out of Cairo. Now, he coughed, you want to encourage Rommel to attack the line at its weakest point, giving him a better chance of getting through. You see? Yes, some parts of the line are weaker than others, and since Rommel has air reconnaissance, there's a chance he'll know which parts. And you want to turn a chance into a certainty. For the sake of the subsequent ambush, yes. Now, it seems to me that we want old Rommel to attack the strongest part of the line so that he won't get through at all. But if we repel him, he'll just regroup and hit us again. Whereas if we trap him, we could finish him off finally. No, no, no. Risky, risky. This is our last line of defense, laddie. Bog laughed. After this, there's nothing but one little canal between him and Cairo. You don't seem to realize.
I realize very well, sir. Let me put it this way. One, if Rommel gets through the line, he must be diverted to Alam Halfa by the false prospect of an easy victory. Two, it is preferable that he attack Alam Halfa from the south because of the quicksand. Three, either we must wait and see which end of the line he attacks and take the risk that he will go north, or we must encourage him to go south and take the risk that we will thereby increase his chances of breaking through the line in the first place.
Well, said Bog, now that we've rephrased it, the plan is beginning to make a little bit more sense. Now look here, you're going to have to leave it with me for a while. When I've got a moment, I'll go through the thing with a fine-toothed comb and see if I can knock it into shape. Then perhaps we'll put it up to the brass.
I see, Van Dam thought. The object of the exercise is to make it Bog's plan. Well, what the hell? If Bog can be bothered to play politics at this stage, good luck to him. It's winning that matters, not getting the credit. Van Dam said, very good, sir. If I might just emphasize the time factor, if the plan is to be put into operation, it must be done quickly.
I think I'm the best judge of its urgency, Major, don't you?
Yes, sir.
And, after all, everything depends on catching the damn spy, something at which you have not so far been entirely successful, am I right?
Yes, sir.
I'll be taking charge of tonight's operation myself, to ensure that there are no further foul-ups. Let me have your proposals this afternoon, and we'll go over them together.
There was a knock at the door, and the brigadier walked in. Van Dam and Bog stood up. Bog said,
good morning, sir. At ease, gentlemen, the brigadier said. I've been looking for you, Van Dam. Bog said, we were just working on an idea we had for a deception plan. Yes, I saw the memo. Ah, Van Dam sent you a copy. Bog said.
Van Dam did not look at Bog, but he knew the lieutenant colonel was furious with him.
Yes, indeed, said the brigadier.
He turned to Van Dam.
You're supposed to be catching spies, Major, not advising generals on strategy. Perhaps if you spent less time telling us how to win the war, you might be a better security officer.
Van Dam's heart sank.
Bog said, I was just saying...
The brigadier interrupted him.
However, since you have done this, and since it's such a splendid plan, I want you to come with me and sell it to Auchinleck. You can spare him, Bog, can't you? Of course, sir, Bog said through clenched teeth. All right, Van Dam. The conference will be starting any minute. Let's go.
Van Dam followed the brigadier out and shut the door very softly on Bog. On the day that Wolf was to see Elena again, Major Smith came to the houseboat at lunchtime. The information he brought with him was the most valuable yet. Wolf and Sonia went through their now familiar routine. Wolf felt like an actor in a French farce who has to hide in the same stage wardrobe night after night. Sonia and Smith, following the script, began on the couch and moved into the bedroom. When Wolf emerged from the cupboard, the curtains were closed, and there on the floor were Smith's briefcase, his shoes, and his shorts, with the key ring poking out of the pocket. Wolf opened the briefcase and began to read. Once again, Smith had come to the houseboat straight from the morning conference at GHQ, at which Auchinleck and his staff discussed Allied strategy and decided what to do. After a few minutes' reading, Wolfe realized that what he held in his hand was a complete rundown of the Allies' last-ditch defense on the El Alamein line. The line consisted of artillery on the ridges, tanks on the level ground, and minefields all along. The Alam Halfa Ridge, 5 miles behind the center of the line, was also heavily fortified. Wolfe noted that the southern end of the line was weaker, both in troops and mines. Smith's briefcase also contained an enemy position paper. Allied intelligence thought Rommel would probably try to break through the line at the southern end, but noted that the northern end was possible. Beneath this, written in pencil in what was presumably Smith's handwriting, was a note which Wolfe found more exciting than all the rest of the stuff put together. It read, "Major Van Dam proposes deception plan. Encourage Rommel to break through at southern end, lure him toward Alam Halfa, catch him in quicksand, then nutcracker. Plan accepted by Auk." Auk was Auchinleck, no doubt. What a discovery this was. Not only did Wolfe hold in his hand the details of the Allied defense line, he also knew what they expected Rommel to do, and he knew their deception plan. And the deception plan was Van Damme's. This would be remembered as the greatest espionage coup of the century. Wolfe himself would be responsible for assuring Rommel's victory in North Africa. "They should make me king of Egypt for this," he thought, and he smiled. He looked up and saw Smith standing between the curtains, staring down at him. Smith roared, "Who the devil are you?" Wolfe realized angrily that he had not been paying attention to the noises from the bedroom. Something had gone wrong. The script had not been followed. There had been no champagne cork warning. He had been totally absorbed in the strategic appreciation. The endless names of divisions and brigades, the numbers of men and tanks, the quantities of fuel and supplies, the ridges and depressions and quicksands had monopolized his attention to the exclusion of local sounds. He was suddenly terribly afraid that he might be thwarted in his moment of triumph. Smith said, "That's my bloody briefcase!" He took a step forward. Wolfe reached out, caught Smith's foot, and heaved sideways. The major toppled over and hit the floor with a heavy thud. Sonia screamed. Wolfe and Smith both scrambled to their feet. Smith was a small, thin man, 10 years older than Wolfe and in poor shape. He stepped backward, fear showing in his face. He bumped into a shelf, glanced sideways, saw a cut-glass fruit bowl on the shelf, picked it up and hurled it at Wolfe. It missed, fell into the kitchen sink, and shattered loudly. "The noise," Wolfe thought. "If he makes any more noise, people will come to investigate." He moved toward Smith. Smith, with his back to the wall, yelled, "Help!" Wolfe hit him once on the point of the jaw, and he collapsed, sliding down the wall to sit unconscious on the floor. Sonia came out and stared at him. Wolfe rubbed his knuckles. "It's the first time I've ever done that," he said. "What?" "Hit somebody on the chin and knocked him out. I thought only boxers could do that." "Never mind that. What are we going to do about him?" "I don't know." Wolfe considered the possibilities. To kill Smith would be dangerous, for the death of an officer and the disappearance of his briefcase would now cause a terrific rumpus throughout the city. There would be the problem of what to do with the body. And Smith would bring home no more secrets. Smith groaned and stirred. Wolfe wondered whether it might be possible to let him go. After all, if Smith were to reveal what had been going on in the houseboat, he would implicate himself. Not only would it ruin his career, he would probably be thrown in jail. He did not look like the kind of man to sacrifice himself for a higher cause. Let him go free? No, the chance was too much to take. To know that there was a British officer in the city who possessed all of Wolfe's secrets, impossible. Smith had his eyes open.
"You," he said, "you're Slavenberg."
He looked at Sonya, then back at Wolf. It was you who introduced... in the cha-cha. This was all planned.
Shut up, Wolf said mildly. Kill him or let him go. What other options were there? Only one. To keep him here, bound and gagged, until Rommel reached Cairo.
You're damned spies,
Smith said. His face was white.
Sonya said nastily, and you thought I was crazy for your miserable body.
Yes, Smith was recovering. I should have known better than to trust a wag bitch.
Sonya stepped forward and kicked his face with her bare foot.
Stop it, Wolf said. We've got to think of what to do with him. Have we got any rope to tie him with?
Sonya thought for a moment.
Up on deck, in that locker at the forward end.
Wolf took from the kitchen drawer the heavy steel he used for sharpening the carving knife. He gave the steel to Sonya.
If he moves, hit him with that, he said.
He did not think Smith would move. He was about to go up the ladder to the deck when he heard footsteps on the gangplank.
Sonya said, Postman!
Wolf knelt in front of Smith and drew his knife.
Open your mouth.
Smith began to say something, and Wolf slid the knife between Smith's teeth.
Wolf said, Now, if you move or speak, I'll cut out your tongue.
Smith sat dead still, staring at Wolf with a horrified look. Wolf realized that Sonya was stark naked.
Put something on, quickly.
She pulled a sheet off the bed and wrapped it around her as she went to the foot of the ladder. The hatch was opening. Wolf knew that he and Smith could be seen from the hatch. Sonya let the sheet slide down a little as she reached up to take the letter from the postman's outstretched hand.
Good morning,
the postman said. His eyes were riveted on Sonya's half-exposed breasts. She went farther up the ladder toward him, so that he had to back away and let the sheet slip even more.
Thank you,
she simpered. She reached for the hatch and pulled it shut. Wolf breathed again. The postman's footsteps crossed the deck and descended the gangplank.
Wolf said to Sonya, Give me that sheet.
She unwrapped herself and stood naked again. Wolf withdrew the knife from Smith's mouth and used it to cut off a foot or two of the sheet. He crumpled the cotton into a ball and stuffed it into Smith's mouth. Smith did not resist. Wolf slid the knife into its underarm sheath. He stood up. Smith closed his eyes. He seemed limp, defeated. Sonya picked up the sharpening steel and stood ready to hit Smith while Wolf went up the ladder and onto the deck. The locker Sonya had mentioned was in the riser of a step in the prow. Wolf opened it. Inside was a coil of slender rope. It had perhaps been used to tie up the vessel in the days before she became a houseboat. Wolf took the rope out. It was strong, but not too thick, ideal for tying someone's hands and feet. He heard Sonya's voice from below raised in a shout. There was a clatter of feet on the ladder. Wolf dropped the rope and whirled around. Smith, wearing only his underpants, came up through the hatch at a run. He had not been as defeated as he looked, and Sonya must have missed him with the steel. Wolf dashed across the deck to the gangplank to head him off. Smith turned, ran to the other side of the boat, and jumped into the water. Wolf said, Shit! He looked all around quickly. There was no one on the decks of the other houseboats. It was the hour of the siesta. The towpath was deserted except for the beggar. Kamel would have to deal with him, and one man in the distance walking away. On the river there were a couple of feluccas, at least a quarter of a mile away, and a slow-moving steam barge beyond them. Wolf ran to the edge. Smith surfaced, gasping for air. He wiped his eyes and looked around to get his bearings. He was clumsy in the water, splashing a lot. He began to swim, inexpertly, away from the houseboat. Wolf stepped back several paces and took a running jump into the river. He landed feet first on Smith's head. For several seconds, all was confusion. Wolf went underwater in a tangle of arms and legs, his and Smith's, and struggled to reach the surface and push Smith down at the same time. When he could hold his breath no longer, he wiggled away from Smith and came up. He sucked air and wiped his eyes. Smith's head bobbed up in front of him, coughing and spluttering.
Wolf reached forward with both hands, grabbed Smith's head, and pulled it toward himself and down. Smith wiggled like a fish. Wolf got him around the neck and pushed down. Wolf himself went under the water, then came up again a moment later. Smith was still under, still struggling. Wolf thought, how long does it take a man to drown? Smith gave a convulsive jerk and freed himself. His head came up, and he heaved a great lungful of air. Wolf tried to punch him. The blow landed, but it had no force. Smith was coughing and retching between shuddering gasps. Wolf himself had taken in water. Wolf reached for Smith again. This time he got behind the major and crooked one arm around the man's throat while he used the other to push down on the top of his head. He thought, Christ, I hope no one is watching. Smith went under. He was face down in the water now, with Wolf's knees in his back and his head held in a firm grip. He continued to thrash around underwater, turning, jerking, flailing his arms, kicking his legs, and trying to twist his body. Wolf tightened his grip and held him under. Drown, you bastard! Drown! He felt Smith's jaws open and knew the man was at last breathing water. The convulsions grew more frantic. Wolf felt he was going to have to let go. Smith's struggle pulled Wolf under. Wolf squeezed his eyes shut and held his breath. It seemed Smith was weakening. By now his lungs must be half full of water, Wolf thought. After a few seconds, Wolf himself began to need air. Smith's movements became feeble. Holding the major less tightly, Wolf kicked himself upward and found air. For a minute, he just breathed. Smith became a dead weight. Wolf used his legs to swim toward the houseboat, pulling Smith with him. Smith's head came up out of the water, but there was no sign of life. Wolf reached the side of the boat. Sonia was up on deck, wearing a robe, staring over the side. Wolf said, Did anybody see? I don't think so. Is he dead? Yes. Wolf thought, What the hell do I do now? He held Smith against the side of the boat. If I let him go, he'll just float, he thought. The body will be found near here, and there will be a house-to-house search. But I can't carry a body half across Cairo to get rid of it. Suddenly, Smith jerked and spewed water. Jesus Christ, he's alive, Wolf said. He pushed Smith under again. This was no good. It took too long. He let Smith go, pulled out his knife, and lunged. Smith was underwater, moving feebly. Wolf could not direct the knife. He slashed wildly. The water hampered him. Smith thrashed about. The foaming water turned pink. At last, Wolf was able to grab Smith by the hair and hold his head still while he cut his throat. Now he was dead. Wolf let Smith go while he sheathed the knife again. The river water turned muddy red all around him. I'm swimming in blood, he thought, and he was suddenly filled with disgust. The body was drifting away. Wolf pulled it back. He realized too late that a drowned major might simply have fallen in the river, but a major with his throat cut had unquestionably been murdered. Now he had to hide the body. He looked up. Sonia, I feel ill. Never mind that. We have to make the body sink to the bottom. Oh, God, the water's all bloody. Listen to me. He wanted to yell at her to make her snap out of it, but he had to keep his voice low. Get that rope. Go on. She disappeared from view for a moment and returned with the rope. She was helpless, Wolf decided. He would have to tell her exactly what to do. Now, get Smith's briefcase and put something heavy in it. Something heavy? But what? Jesus Christ, what have we got that's heavy? What's heavy? Books. Books are heavy. No, that might not be enough. I know. Bottles. Full bottles. Champagne bottles. Fill his briefcase with full bottles of champagne. Why? My God, stop dithering. Do what I tell you. She went away again. Through the porthole, he could see her coming down the ladder and into the living room. She was moving very slowly, like a sleepwalker. Hurry, you fat bitch, hurry! She looked around her, dazedly. Still moving in slow motion, she picked up the briefcase from the floor. She took it to the kitchen area and opened the icebox. She looked in, as if she were deciding what to have for dinner.
Come on!
She took out a champagne bottle. She stood with the bottle in one hand and the briefcase in the other, and she frowned, as if she could not remember what she was supposed to be doing with them. At last her expression cleared, and she put the bottle in the case, laying it flat. She took another bottle out.
Wolf thought, "Lay them head to toe, idiot, so you get more in."
She put the second bottle in, looked at it, then took it out, and turned it the other way.
Brilliant, Wolf thought.
She managed to get four bottles in. She closed the icebox and looked around for something else to add to the weight. She picked up the sharpening steel and a glass paperweight. She put those into the briefcase and fastened it. Then she came up on deck.
What now? She said. Tie the end of the rope around the handle of the briefcase.
She was coming out of her daze. Her fingers moved more quickly.
Tie it very tight, Wolf said.
Okay.
Is there anyone around?
She glanced to left and right.
No. Hurry.
She finished the knot.
Throw me the rope, Wolf said.
She threw down the other end of the rope, and he caught it. He was tiring with the effort of keeping himself afloat and holding on to the corpse at the same time. He had to let Smith go for a moment because he needed both hands for the rope, which meant he had to tread water furiously to stay up. He threaded the rope under the dead man's armpits and pulled it through. He wound it around the torso twice, then tied a knot. Several times during the operation, he found himself sinking, and once he took a revolting mouthful of bloody water. At last, the job was done.
"Test your knot," he told Sonia. "It's tight. Throw the briefcase into the water. Throw it as far out as you can."
She heaved the briefcase over the side. It splashed a couple of yards away from the houseboat. It had been too heavy for her to throw far, and went down. Slowly, the rope followed the case. The length of rope between Smith and the case became taut. Then the body went under. Wolf watched the surface. The knots were holding. He kicked his legs underwater where the body had gone down. They did not contact anything. The body had sunk deep. Wolf muttered,
"Leap of God, what a shambles!"
He climbed on deck. Looking back down, he saw that the pink tinge was rapidly disappearing from the water. A voice said, "Good morning!" Wolf and Sonia whirled around to face the towpath.
"Good morning," Sonia replied.
She muttered to Wolf in an undertone,
"A neighbor."
The neighbor was a half-caste woman of middle age, carrying a shopping basket. She said,
"I heard a lot of splashing. Is there anything wrong?"
No, Sonia said. "My little dog fell in the water, and Mr. Robinson here had to rescue him."
"How gallant," the woman said. "I didn't know you had a dog."
"He's a puppy, a gift."
"What kind?"
Wolf wanted to scream,
"Go away, you stupid old woman."
"A poodle," Sonia replied. "I'd love to see him. Tomorrow, perhaps. He's been locked up as a punishment now."
"Poor thing," Wolf said.
"I'd better change my wet clothes."
Sonia said to the neighbor,
"Until tomorrow."
"Lovely to meet you, Mr. Robinson," the neighbor said.
Wolf and Sonia went below. Sonia slumped on the couch and closed her eyes. Wolf stripped off his wet clothes. Sonia said, "It's the worst thing that's ever happened to me."
"You'll survive," Wolf said.
"At least it was an Englishman."
"Yes, you should be jumping for joy."
"I will when my stomach settles." Wolf went into the bathroom and turned on the taps of the tub. When he came back, Sonia said, "Was it worth it?"
"Yes."
Wolf pointed to the military papers which were still on the floor, where he had dropped them when Smith surprised him.
"That stuff is red hot. The best he's ever brought us. With that, Rommel can win the war."
"When will you send it?"
"Tonight, at midnight."
"Tonight you're going to bring Elena here."
He stared at her. "How can you think of that when we've just killed a man and sunk his body?"
She stared at him defiantly. "I don't know. I just know it makes me feel very sexy."
"My God."
"You will bring her home tonight. You owe it to me."
Wolf hesitated. "I'd have to make the broadcast while she's here."
"I'll keep her busy while you're on the radio." I don't know. Damn it, Alex, you owe me. All right. Thank you.
Wolf went into the bathroom. Sonia was unbelievable, he thought. She took depravity to new heights of sophistication. He got into the hot water. She called from the bedroom,
"But now Smith won't be bringing you any more secrets."
"I don't think we'll need them after the next battle," Wolf replied. "He's served his purpose."
He picked up the soap and began to wash off the blood. Chapter 21 Van Damme knocked at the door of Elena's flat an hour before she was due to meet Alex Wolf. She came to the door wearing a black cocktail dress and high-heeled black shoes with silk stockings. Around her neck was a slender gold chain. Her face was made up, and her hair gleamed. She had been expecting Van Damme. He smiled at her, seeing someone familiar, yet at the same time astonishingly beautiful.
"Hello."
"Come in." She led him into the living room. "Sit down." He had wanted to kiss her, but she had not given him the chance. He sat on the couch.
"I wanted to tell you the details for tonight."
"Okay." She sat on a chair opposite him. "Do you want a drink?"
"Sure."
"Help yourself." He stared at her.
"Is something wrong?"
"Nothing. Give yourself a drink, then brief me."
Van Damme frowned. "What is this?"
"Nothing. We've got work to do, so let's do it."
He stood up, went across to her, and knelt in front of her chair.
"Elena, what are you doing?"
She glared at him. She seemed close to tears. She said loudly, "Where have you been for the last 2 days?"
He looked away from her, thinking.
"I've been at work."
"And where do you think I've been?"
"Here, I suppose."
"Exactly." He did not understand what that meant. It crossed his mind that he had fallen in love with a woman he hardly knew. He said,
"I've been working, and you've been here. And so you're mad at me?"
She shouted, "Yes."
Van Damme said, "Calm down. I don't understand why you're so cross, and I want you to explain it to me."
"No."
"Then I don't know what to say."
Van Damme sat on the floor with his back to her and lit a cigarette. He truly did not know what had upset her, but there was an element of willfulness in his attitude. He was ready to be humble, to apologize for whatever he had done, and to make amends, but he was not willing to play guessing games. They sat in silence for a minute, not looking at one another. Elena sniffed. Van Damme could not see her, but he knew the kind of sniff that came from weeping. She said, "You could have sent me a note, or even a bunch of bloody flowers."
"A note? What for? You knew we were to meet tonight."
"Oh, my God. Flowers?
What do you want with flowers? We don't need to play that game anymore."
"Oh, really?
What do you want me to say?"
"Listen, we made love the night before last, in case you've forgotten."
"Don't be silly.
You brought me home and kissed me goodbye. Then, nothing."
He drew on his cigarette. "In case you have forgotten, a certain Erwin Rommel is knocking at the gates with a bunch of Nazis in tow, and I'm one of the people who's trying to keep him out."
5 minutes. That's all it would have taken to send me a note.
"What for?"
"Well, exactly, what for? I'm a loose woman, am I not? I give myself to a man the way I take a drink of water. An hour later, I've forgotten. Is that what you think? Because that's how it seems to me. Damn you, William Van Damme, you make me feel cheap."
It made no more sense than it had at the start. But now he could hear the pain in her voice. He turned to face her. "You're the most wonderful thing that's happened to me for a long time. Perhaps ever. Please forgive me for being a fool."
He took her hand in his own. She looked toward the window, biting her lip, fighting back tears.
"Yes, you are," she said.
She looked down at him and touched his hair. "You bloody, bloody fool," she whispered, stroking his head. Her eyes spilled tears.
"I've such a lot to learn about you," he said.
"And I about you." He looked away, thinking aloud. "People resent my equanimity."
Always have. Those who work for me don't. They like it. They know that when they feel like panicking, when they feel they can't cope, they can come to me and tell me about the dilemma. And if I can't see a way through it, I'll tell them what is the best thing to do, the lesser evil. And because I say it in a calm voice, because I see that it's a dilemma, and I don't panic, they go away reassured and do what they have to do. All I do is clarify the problem and refuse to be frightened by it. But that's just what they need. However, exactly the same attitude often infuriates other people. My superiors, my friends, Angela, you. I've never understood why.
Because sometimes you should panic, fool, she said softly. Sometimes you should show that you are frightened or obsessed or crazy for something. It's human, and it's a sign that you care. When you're so calm all the time, we think it's because you don't give a damn.
Van Damme said, well, people should know better. Lovers should know better, and so should friends, and bosses if they're any good. He said this honestly, but in the back of his mind he realized that there was indeed an element of ruthlessness, of cold-heartedness, in his famous equanimity.
And if they don't know better?
She had stopped crying now. I should be different? No. He wanted to be honest with her now. He could have told her a lie to make her happy. Yes, you're right, I'll try to be different. But what was the point? If he could not be himself with her, it was all worthless. He would be manipulating her the way all men had manipulated her, the way he manipulated people he did not love. So he told her the truth. You see, this is the way I win. I mean, win everything. The game of life, so to speak. He gave a wry grin. I am detached. I look at everything from a distance. I do care. But I refuse to do pointless things, symbolic gestures, empty fits of rage. Either we love each other or we don't. And all the flowers in the world won't make any difference. But the work I did today could affect whether we live or die. I did think of you all day. But each time I thought of you, I turned my mind to more urgent things. I work efficiently, I set priorities, and I don't worry about you when I know you're okay. Can you imagine yourself getting used to that? She gave him a watery smile. I'll try. And all the time, in the back of his mind, he was thinking, for how long? Do I want this woman forever? What if I don't? He pushed the thought down. Right now it was low priority. What I want to say after all that is, forget about tonight. Don't go. We'll manage without you. But I can't. We need you, and it's terribly important. That's okay, I understand. But first of all, may I kiss you hello? Yes, please.
This ends side one of cassette 7. Please turn the cassette over and start side 2 at the same point.
Kneeling beside the arm of her chair, he took her face in his big hand and kissed her lips. Her mouth was soft and yielding, and slightly moist. He savored the feel and the taste of her. Never had he felt like this, as though he could go on kissing just so, all night and never get tired. Eventually she drew back, took a deep breath, and said, "My, my, I do believe you mean it. You may be sure of that." She laughed. When you said that, you were the old Major Van Damme for a moment, the one I used to know before I knew you. And your my my in that provocative voice was the old Elena. Brief me, Major. I'll have to get out of kissing distance. Sit over there and cross your legs. Anyway, what were you doing today? Van Damme crossed the room to the drinks cupboard and found the gin. A major in intelligence has disappeared, along with a briefcase full of secrets.
Wolf?
Could be. It turns out that this major has been disappearing at lunchtime a couple of times a week, and nobody knows where he's been going. I've a hunch that he might have been meeting Wolf.
So why would he disappear?
Van Damme shrugged. Something went wrong.
What was in his briefcase today?
Van Damme wondered how much to tell her. A rundown of our defenses, which was so complete that we think it could alter the result of the next battle. Smith had also been in possession of Van Damme's proposed deception plan, but Van Damme did not tell Elena this. He trusted her all the way, but he also had security instincts. He finished, "So we'd better catch Wolf tonight."
"But it might be too late already."
"No. We found the decrypt of one of Wolf's signals a while back. It was timed at midnight. Spies have a set time for reporting, generally the same time every day. At other times, their masters won't be listening, at least not on the right wavelength. So even if they do signal, nobody picks it up. Therefore, I think Wolf will send this information tonight at midnight, unless I catch him first." He hesitated, then changed his mind about security and decided she ought to know the full importance of what she was doing. "There's something else. He's using a code based on a novel called Rebecca. I've got a copy of the novel. If I can get the key to the code..."
"What's that?"
"Just a piece of paper telling him how to use the book to encode signals."
"Go on."
"If I can get the key to the Rebecca code, I can impersonate Wolf over the radio and send false information to Rommel. It could turn the tables completely. It could save Egypt. But I must have the key."
"All right. What's tonight's plan?"
"It's the same as before, only more so. I'll be in the restaurant with Jakes, and we'll both have pistols."
Her eyes widened. "You've got a gun?"
"I haven't got it now. Jakes is bringing it to the restaurant. Anyway, there will be two other men in the restaurant, and six more outside on the pavement, trying to look inconspicuous. There will also be civilian cars ready to block all exits from the street at the sound of a whistle. No matter what Wolf does tonight, if he wants to see you, he's going to be caught." There was a knock at the apartment door. Van Damme said, "What's that?"
"The door."
"Yes, I know. Are you expecting someone? Or something?"
"No, of course not. It's almost time for me to leave."
Van Damme frowned. Alarm bells were sounding. "I don't like this. Don't answer."
"All right," Elena said. Then she changed her mind. "I have to answer it. It might be my father, or news of him."
"Okay. Answer it." Elena went out of the living room. Van Damme sat listening. The knock came again. Then she opened the door. Van Damme heard her say, "Alex!" Van Damme whispered, "Christ!" He heard Wolf's voice. "You're all ready. How delightful." It was a deep, confident voice. The drawled English spoken with only the faintest trace of an indefinable accent. Elena said,
"Of course."
"I know. May I come in?" Van Damme leaped over the back of the sofa and lay on the floor behind it. Elena said,
"Of course."
Wolf's voice came closer. "My dear, you look exquisite tonight." Van Damme thought, "Smooth bastard." The front door slammed shut. Wolf said, "This way?"
Yes.
Van Damme heard the two of them enter the room. Wolf said, "What a lovely apartment. Mikis Aristopoulos must pay you well."
"Oh, I don't work there regularly. He's a distant relation. It's family. I help out."
"Uncle. He must be your uncle."
"Oh, great uncle, second cousin, something. He calls me his niece for simplicity."
"Well, these are for you."
"Oh, flowers. Thank you."
Van Damme thought, "Fuck that." Wolf said, "May I sit down?"
"Of course."
Van Damme felt the sofa shift as Wolf lowered his weight onto it. Wolf was a big man. Van Damme remembered grappling with him in the alley. He also remembered the knife, and his hand went to the wound on his cheek. He thought, "What can I do?" He could jump Wolf now. The spy was here, practically in his hands. They were about the same weight and evenly matched, except for the knife. Wolf had had the knife that night when they had been dining with Sonia, so presumably he took it everywhere with him and had it now. If they fought, and Wolf had the advantage of the knife, Wolf would win. It happened before, in the alley. Van Damme touched his cheek again. He thought, why didn't I bring the gun here? If they fought and Wolf won, what would happen then? Seeing Van Damme in Elena's apartment, Wolf would know she had been trying to trap him. What would he do to her? In Istanbul, in a similar situation, he had slit the girl's throat. Van Damme blinked to shut out the awful image. Wolf said, I see you were having a drink before I arrived. May I join you? Of course, Elena said again. What would you like? What's that? Wolf sniffed. Oh, a little gin would be very nice. Van Damme thought, that was my drink. Thank God Elena didn't have a drink as well. Two glasses would have given the game away. He heard ice clink. Cheers, Wolf said. Cheers? You don't seem to like it. The ice has melted. Van Damme knew why she had made a face when she sipped his drink. It had been straight gin. She was coping so well with the situation, he thought. What did she think he, Van Damme, was planning to do? She must have guessed by now where he was hiding. She would be trying desperately not to look in his direction. Poor Elena. Once again, she had got more than she bargained for. Van Damme hoped she would be passive, take the line of least resistance, and trust him. Did Wolf still plan to go to the Oasis restaurant? Perhaps he did. If only I could be sure of that, Van Damme thought, I could leave it all to Jake's. Wolf said, You seem nervous, Elena. Did I confuse your plans by coming here? If you want to go and finish getting ready or something, not that you look a whit less than perfect right now, just leave me here with the gin bottle. No, no. Well, we did say we'd meet at the restaurant. And here I am, altering everything at the last minute again. To be truthful, I'm bored with restaurants. And yet they are, so to speak, the conventional meeting place. So I arrange to have dinner with people. Then when the time comes, I can't face it, and I think of something else to do. So they're not going to the Oasis, Van Damme thought. Damn. Elena said, What do you want to do? May I surprise you again? Van Damme thought, Make him tell you. Elena said, All right. Van Damme groaned inwardly. If Wolf would reveal where they were going, Van Damme could contact Jake's and have the whole ambush moved to the new venue. Elena was not thinking the right way. It was understandable. She sounded terrified. Wolf said, Shall we go? All right. The sofa creaked as Wolf got up. Van Damme thought, I could go for him now. Too risky. He heard them leave the room. He stayed where he was for a moment. He heard Wolf in the hallway say, After you. Then the front door was slammed shut. Van Damme stood up. He would have to follow them and take the first available opportunity of calling GHQ and contacting Jake's. Elena did not have a telephone. Not many people did in Cairo. Even if she had, there was no time now. He went to the front door and listened. He heard nothing. He opened it a fraction. They had gone. He went out, closed the door, and hurried along the corridor and down the stairs. As he stepped out of the building, he saw them on the other side of the road. Wolf was holding open a car door for Elena to get in. It was not a taxi. Wolf must have rented, borrowed, or stolen a car for the evening. Wolf closed the door on Elena and walked around to the driver's side. Elena looked out of the window and caught Van Damme's eye. She stared at him. He looked away from her, afraid to make any kind of gesture in case Wolf should see it. Van Damme walked to his motorcycle, climbed on, and started the engine. Wolf's car pulled away, and Van Damme followed. The city traffic was still heavy. Van Damme was able to keep 5 or 6 cars between himself and Wolf without risking losing Wolf. It was dusk, but few cars had their lights on. Van Damme wondered where Wolf was going. They were sure to stop somewhere, unless the man intended to drive around all night. If only they would stop someplace where there was a telephone. They headed out of the city,
toward Giza. Darkness fell, and Wolf illuminated the lights of the car. Van Damme left his motorcycle lights off so that Wolf would not be able to see that he was being followed. It was a nightmare ride. Even in daylight in the city, riding a motorcycle was a little hair-raising. The roads were strewn with bumps, potholes, and treacherous patches of oil, and Van Damme found he had to watch the surface as much as the traffic. The desert road was worse, and yet he now had to drive without lights and keep an eye on the car ahead. Three or four times he almost came off the bike. He was cold. Not anticipating this ride, he had worn only a short-sleeved uniform shirt, and at speed, the wind cut through it. How far was Wolf planning to go? The pyramids loomed ahead. Van Damme thought, no phone there. Wolf's car slowed down. They were going to picnic by the pyramids. Van Damme cut the motorcycle engine and coasted to a halt. Before Wolf had a chance to get out of the car, Van Damme wheeled his bike off the road onto the sand. The desert was not level, except when seen from a distance, and he found a rocky hump behind which to lay down the motorcycle. He lay in the sand beside the hump and watched the car. Nothing happened. The car stayed still, its engine off, its interior dark. What were they doing in there? Van Damme was seized by jealousy. He told himself not to be stupid. They were eating, that was all. Elena had told him about the last picnic, the smoked salmon, the cold chicken, the champagne. You could not kiss a girl with a mouthful of fish. Still, their fingers would touch as he handed her the wine. Shut up. He decided to risk a cigarette. He moved behind the hump to light it, then cupped it in his hand, army fashion, to hide the glow as he returned to his vantage point. Five cigarettes later, the car doors opened. The cloud had cleared, and the moon was out. The whole landscape was dark blue and silver, the complex shadow work of the pyramids rising out of shining sand. Two dark figures got out of the car and walked toward the nearest of the ancient tombs. Van Damme could see that Elena walked with her arms folded across her chest, as if she were cold, or perhaps because she did not want to hold Wolf's hand. Wolf put an arm lightly across her shoulders, and she made no move to resist him. They stopped at the base of the monument and talked. Wolf pointed upward, and Elena seemed to shake her head. Van Damme guessed she did not want to climb. They walked around the base and disappeared behind the pyramid. Van Damme waited for them to emerge on the other side. They seemed to take a very long time. What were they doing behind there? The urge to go and see was almost irresistible. He could get to the car now. He toyed with the idea of sabotaging it, rushing back to the city and returning with his team. But Wolf would not be here when Van Damme got back. It would be impossible to search the desert at night. By the morning, Wolf might be miles away. It was almost unbearable to watch and wait and do nothing. But Van Damme knew it was the best course. At last, Wolf and Elena came back into view. He still had his arm around her. They returned to the car and stood beside the door. Wolf put his hands on Elena's shoulders, said something, and leaned forward to kiss her. Van Damme stood up. Elena gave Wolf her cheek, then turned away, slipping out of his grasp, and got into the car. Van Damme lay down on the sand again. The desert silence was broken by the roar of Wolf's car. Van Damme watched it turn in a wide circle and take the road. The headlights came on, and Van Damme ducked his head involuntarily, although he was well concealed. The car passed him, heading toward Cairo. Van Damme jumped up, wheeled his cycle onto the road, and kicked the starter. The engine would not turn over. Van Damme cursed. He was terrified he might have gotten sand in the carburetor. He tried again, and this time it fired. He got on and followed the car. The moonlight made it easier for him to spot the holes and bumps in the road surface, but it also made him more visible. He stayed well behind Wolf's car, knowing there was nowhere to go but Cairo. He wondered what Wolf planned next. Would he take Elena home? If so, where would he go afterward? He might lead Van Damme to his base. Van Damme thought,
I wish I had that gun. Would Wolf take Elena to his home? The man had to be staying somewhere, had to have a bed in a room in a building in the city. Van Damme was sure Wolf was planning to seduce Elena. Wolf had been rather patient and gentlemanly with her, but Van Damme knew that in reality he was a man who liked to get his way quickly. Seduction might be the least of the dangers Elena faced. Van Damme thought, what wouldn't I give for a phone? They reached the outskirts of the city, and Van Damme was obliged to pull up closer to the car, but fortunately there was plenty of traffic about. He contemplated stopping and giving a message to a policeman or an officer, but Wolf was driving fast, and anyway, what would the message say? Van Damme still did not know where Wolf was going. He began to suspect the answer when they crossed the bridge to Zamalek. This was where the dancer Sonia had her houseboat. It was surely not possible that Wolf was living there, Van Damme thought, for the place had been under surveillance for days. But perhaps he was reluctant to take Elena to his real home, and so was borrowing the houseboat. Wolf parked in a street and got out. Van Damme stood his motorcycle against a wall and hurriedly chained the wheel to prevent theft. He might need the bike again tonight. He followed Wolf and Elena from the street to the towpath. From behind a bush, he watched as they walked a short distance along the path. He wondered what Elena was thinking. Had she expected to be rescued before this? Would she trust that Van Damme was still watching her? Would she now lose hope? They stopped beside one of the boats. Van Damme noted carefully which one, and Wolf helped Elena onto the gangplank. Van Damme thought, has it not occurred to Wolf that the houseboat might be under surveillance? Obviously not. Wolf followed Elena onto the deck, then opened a hatch. The two of them disappeared below. Van Damme thought, what now? This was surely his best chance to fetch help. Wolf must be intending to spend some time on the boat. But supposing that did not happen? Suppose while Van Damme was dashing to a phone, something went wrong? Elena insisted on being taken home. Wolf changed his